So good morning. I'm Sanjay Kumar, your host for New Books in South Asia series. And I have the pleasure and privilege today to introduce to you a wonderful book, Cultivating Community, Interest, Identity and Ambiguity in Indian Social Mobilization by Michael Youngblood, who received his PhD in Cultural Anthropology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you, Sanjay.
To start with, as I say, I can see that the book has been a result of your PhD dissertation in cultural anthropology. Would you like to share with our readers the impetus for writing this book?
Sure. It actually goes back quite a ways into my younger years. I grew up in a fairly typical American suburb in the Midwestern states, and grew increasingly frustrated in my youth about how isolated I was from things happening not only in bigger cities, but also in the rest of the world. And so when I was in college, again in the Midwest, I became fascinated with the idea of going to a part of the earth that was as different as I could imagine. India somehow captured my fascination as a place that epitomized that, in part because I realized that if you sort of drilled a hole through the globe, you would end up somewhere around India on the complete opposite side of the planet. So I became fascinated with India, and I had an opportunity to go study in India during my college years. So I spent a year on a program in Maharashtra affiliated with the University of Pune. And while there, I was quite aware of a number of interesting social movements happening around the city of Pune and in Maharashtra in general. And many years later, when I was in graduate school, as an anthropology student, I thought back to some of those interesting movements that I had heard of and some occasions witnessed in Maharashtra. And one in particular, the Shetkari Sanghatna, had sort of stuck in my mind as a movement that seemed not only quite robust and interesting, but also in some ways a little bit paradoxical. It raised some questions for me that I continued to be fascinated with. So I did a little research, learned that that movement was still happening and still quite robust. And as I approached the time to determine a thesis topic for my graduate studies, I thought that the Shetkari Sanghatna would be a very interesting thing to pursue further. So in short, a few years later, I found myself landing back in Maharashtra State and buying a motorcycle and scooting around the state as much as I could and trying to find out what was happening with that movement, and spent about 3 years in that process.
Thank you, Mike. I mean, it comes out very well in your introduction too, and it's very interesting to read how the whole journey of your research into this book really reads like a voyage into a social movement. So that was very heartening to read. My first question would be something which I take up from your own introduction, where you frame the theoretical framework of this book. And you basically say that the book explores the motivations and subjectivity of participants, I quote, in a mass social movement. My question would be that you hear in this section, you also speak about a critique, which you claim that you would like to examine about how literature on social movements have looked at movements from the non-Western world. And if I may use your words, of non-Western subjects. And this is interesting because in India, one always associates social movements with mass change. And you use the word mass social movement. So would you be able to tell us a bit more? Why did you pick on this movement? And would you think that that really represents, in some sense, many Indian social movements?
Yeah, that's interesting. So what I mean by mass social movement, it was some it was a language that I was using to differentiate something like the Shritkari Sangatana from something that is much more specific to a identifiable interest group, where we can understand why that particular group of individuals would come together around a relatively tightly defined cause. I'm thinking of some other struggles in India, for example, where you have certain social segments struggling for rights of access to land that is of customary use. For example, some of the Adivasi movements around the country, or what are often the communities that are often referred to as tribal. So the indigenous folks of particular lands, a relatively tightly defined social interest group, or perhaps the Chipko Andolan movement in the north. So in something like the Shritkari Sangatana, what we see is a very broad swath of society coming together, fighting for ostensibly the same thing. So we have they're predominantly folks who live in rural areas, but what we see is a very broad economic spectrum. So people who are who might be labeled rich farmers, so folks with large tracts of land and shiny tractors, all the way down to folks who are really marginal landholders who are just sort of scraping by and growing enough food to feed their families and maybe participating in the market a little bit when they have a surplus, but mostly feeding their families. And even landless laborers, folks who have no land and sell themselves out as laborers on other people's property. So this is what I mean by mass. It's quite a broad spectrum of folks, mm-hmm. and yet they're coming together and on the surface, at least, fighting for the same sort of economic goals, the same concessions from local and national government in terms of reforming the economy. But these goals seem a little bit paradoxical for different social segments within that broad slice of humanity. So I was trying to tease apart what it is that's happening when you have such a broad group of people angling for the same kinds of outcomes, or at least on the surface.
Excellent. When I look at the structure of the book, and when I go back to the subtitle of the book, you speak about interest, identity, and ambiguity. And these are the three key terms that are brought up in a very theoretically nuanced way. Just for the sake of the audience of the show, would you like to speak a bit more on how you unpack the concept of ambiguity in this book in the context of the Shetkari Sangatana?
Sure. So ambiguity is something that I found quite fascinating. I'll give you a little background into how I found my way into my understanding of the movement. And I think it's probably has a lot of parallels in the way we think about other movements around the world. When you speak with folks, or when you observe them in the Shritkari Sangatana participating in the movement, what you see is people are using a very common idiom of the movement. They talk about the issues and who they are and what they stand for in a very similar way. They behave as if they are sort of in lockstep agreement. So when you watch a rally of 10,000 or 20,000 people, you'll see them sort of raising their fists in response to the same the same slogans being said by the leaders. They sing songs together that were written in the movement. They wear similar outfits to identify themselves as participants in the movement. They're even struggling in ways that are very likely to get them hurt. There's quite a number of folks in the Shritkari Sangatana who have been put in jail numerous times, or have been beaten by the police in order to break up large rallies, and there are folks who have been martyred, who have been shot and perished. So there seems to be this extraordinary level of commitment and extraordinary level of solidarity and common identity. And I think that's, as outsiders, how we tend to view movements in general, wherever they're happening in the world. I mean, I think of things, not to compare these as apples to apples, but if you look at movements like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and you think about how we tend to see all of these folks as sort of a hive of like thinkers. As I got into the field and started working with the Shetkari Sanghatna, I spent a lot of time trying to find people who represented that. So I spoke with leaders, I spoke with mid-level organizers and local level leaders, and I spoke with plenty of activists and ordinary participants. And I had a very hard time, except at the top of the leadership, I had a very hard time finding people who, in a one-on-one conversation or in their household, spoke of the movement in those same terms of absolute solidarity and common identity and agreement with everything that the leaders have to say. And I began to realize that a lot of these things, these slogans, these points of agenda that the leaders were articulating, these future visions of what the world will look like after the movement is successful, they're quite ambiguous and people are interpreting them in their own ways. I think we see that, for example, here at in the United States with some of the recent political campaigns that we've seen going on, where there's a great deal of kind of vague promises being made or vague sloganeering, and a lot of people seem to be extraordinarily enthusiastic about what they're hearing. And I suspect that the same kind of phenomenon is occurring, where these things are really quite ambiguous, and people recognize their ambiguity more than we give them credit for. And what they're actually doing is using that ambiguity as a resource. This is an opportunity to help define and shape what this means and what this movement can become and who it's going to serve, because it can't serve everybody. It has to at some point define itself in terms of a particular lower level agenda that it's going to pursue. So ambiguity for me is a window on how a movement functions when it includes such a broad swath of folks. And I began to see it as not a weakness of movements, that lack of definition, but actually sort of a template for opportunity. It's part of what makes those movements capable of bringing in so many people and keeping them so dynamic, because of that struggle to internally to define what's going on.
That makes perfect sense, Michael. If I may just move further into the chapters of the book, and when you speak about in chapter 2, the contours of community and place, You give a very vivid picture of the cultural context of the state of Maharashtra and how identity is signified there in a historical context. And I'm sure for many of the listeners of this show, it's also important to know that this has been a state which has also produced many important political figures in the recent times, and some of whom have had big mass appeal, like Bal Thackeray, for instance. And I think that you also touch upon the issue of, very interestingly, the question of caste and linguistic issues and identity. I just want to see, how did you find, when you went in as a researcher, especially as somebody coming from another cultural background, what was it that struck you most about the way in which all these identity markers played up in the context of Maharashtra in terms of the Shetkari Sanghatna?
Yeah, and I'll take it back to the idea of ambiguity. So I became kind of fascinated with how contentious many of the seemingly deeply rooted and well-formed notions of identity across the state are. there is the notion of Maharashtrianness. There is the notion of caste affiliation for some folks. There is the notion of regional affiliations and what they mean. And as I explored the history of Maharashtra, I realized that these things have been much more porous than we understand. There's been a lot of boundary shifting around some of these notions of who is and what is Marathi and who is and what is Maharashtrian, as well as what sort of the key symbols of that have meant throughout history. So great leaders like Shivaji or some of the other more current cultural figures like Bhav Thackeray and the kinds of symbols that he invokes. What we see again is sort of there has been this long ongoing competition to define the markers of identity within the state. And in doing that, to sort of craft the boundaries of identity, historical and geographical and cultural. So I was looking at some of those other struggles to define throughout Maharashtrian history as a way to jump forward and look at something like the Shetkari Sanghatna as not an unusual new type of social project, but as something that's really quite human and has been going on forever in a way that's very clearly visible in Maharashtra and in a way that's common to all of us. I think this is a very sort of ordinary human setup and state of affairs.
Thank you. On the note of the being human, I think what I liked also about the structure of the book is where you have structured the argument across chapters. And if I look at chapter 3, 4, and 5, what really strikes me about chapter 3 is you really bring in the question of leadership and the figure of Sharad Joshi, which is, of course, taken up later on. Would you like to say something more about what did you find as an anthropologist studying social movements about the persona of Sharad Joshi and all its problematic briefly?
He's a fascinating guy. He unfortunately passed away last year. But I disagreed with him on many things, but I was fortunate to spend a lot of time with him. He was extraordinarily, as was everybody in the movement, extraordinarily welcoming to me. And even when they recognized that I was not necessarily an ally, though I think they trusted that I was not an enemy, they were able to see me as a scholar who was simply interested in understanding what they were doing. And Joshi was particularly good at this. But the man was extraordinarily intriguing. He was, for those who don't know anything about him, he was not the typical kind of Indian rural politician to come on the scene or Indian rural leader. The folks that we normally associate with leadership in rural India are people who, in one way or another, craft themselves or their followers craft them as sons of the soil, people who really have ties to agriculture, people who really understand the cultural and material existence in rural areas, and people who are in one way or another incorporated in the social structure and the power structure of rural areas. Sharad Joshi comes into rural Maharashtra as somebody who grew up in the city, had been a bureaucrat with the UN based in Switzerland, didn't really know farming. He bought some land and retreated to the countryside as a gentleman farmer. His common, standard outfit was a golf shirt and a pair of blue jeans and some tennis shoes. He didn't try at all to craft himself as a rural, as a brother from the land. And this struck a lot of people as being really problematic and unlikely. And, he won't succeed, and oh my gosh, he is succeeding. How is this possible? And I think actually it goes back to this notion of ambiguity. Because he was an outsider, because he, in rural terms, was sort of a blank template, it was not clear who he was and what he could become as a leader for rural folks. And people used that ambiguity about his persona and who he was to try and craft him. And some of this is conscious and some of this is unconscious. But I saw a real sort of participatory crafting of who Shota Joshi became. And indeed, he invited that. His mode of interaction with folks was to really listen quite a bit and to ask them to just see him as a fellow activist rather than the leader of the movement, and to engage him in conversation rather than to have this dynamic of leader on the one hand and follower on the other hand. So, fascinating man, and I'd love to talk with him some more, but I'm not sure. Did I answer your question?
I did. You did.
Okay.
I think I'll just move on further, because I think what that fascination with the figure of Sharad Joshi takes me further to chapter 5, which is about Bali, and the title very well, Bali Will Rise, Dialogics of Interest and Identity Continued. Here, if I may indulge a bit personally, I'm from the southwestern state of India, from Kerala, where we have our annual festival called Onam, which celebrates the return of the mythical king Mahabali. And what I found really fascinating here was that the entire chapter talks about how rituals, the way in which the demonic king's persona is mapped onto the leader, and of course the whole idea of the Puranic worldview in Maharashtra. I was curious to know if in Kerala recently there was a controversy with the BJP Hindu right-wing government trying to say that Onam, the festival which celebrates the return of the king Mahabali, who is supposed to have been the erstwhile ruler of Kerala, should be instead celebrated as Vamana Jayanti and not Mahabali's return because he's a demon. I think it would be nice if you can tell us more in terms of how you found the Bali Purana playing out in the case of this social movement briefly.
Sure. So in India, as I understand, there are really two regions of the country where Mahabali is highly revered. And so one of them indeed is Kerala, and the other is Maharashtra. Though in Maharashtra, Bali plays a much quieter role in cultural life. There are no major festivals for Bali. But Maharashtrian agriculturalists, Shetkaris, they identify with Bali to an extraordinary extent. In fact, they frequently refer to each other as Bali. They'll greet each other on the street as Bali. And they also see Bali as sort of this once upon a time great king with extraordinary powers. He's a demon. He's a benevolent demon with some sort of supernatural capabilities, but he was king of the whole region. And so when the Shetkari Sanghatna talks about the future, they actually talk about it in terms of the past. And we see this in lots of other movements as well. They want to sort of make the region great again. And they talk about that restoration of greatness as a return to the kingdom of Bali before he was overthrown by Vamana. Now, there's a interesting correlation that they make between Sharad Joshi and Bali. So they see, or they, at least in the idiom of the movement, there's some talk of Sharad Joshi actually being an incarnation of Bali. So he is sort of the first step toward reestablishing the great kingdom of Bali from the past. Now, it's unclear whether people really believe this or if this is just sort of an idiomatic way of talking about what's happening in the movement, because we have to remember that farmers themselves talk about each other as Bali. And there's some contention about who the real Balis are. In Maharashtrian folklore, Bully is seen as sort of a put upon figure, a noble person who was overthrown unjustly by the established powers. And this is kind of how the farmers view themselves, the farmers and peasants of the Shetkari Sangatna in Maharashtra. And so to raise one up as Bali is, on the one hand, sort of looking at them as a supernatural being returning from the past. But on another hand, it's really a very sort of day-to-day pedestrian way of validating the trials and tribulations of being an agriculturalist in Maharashtra.
Excellent. I guess the complexity of your argument would be difficult to capture in our interview, but I can definitely say that one thing that really comes out from the reading of the book is that you speak about the multiple narratives which kind of populate a movement. And also you go in depth in terms of looking at the different theories of social movement and how some of them are validated or not. When I come to the conclusion of the book and I look at the kind of arguments that you present forward, one thing that really struck me was that I thought I would go back to the title. The key word there is cultivating community. And I just wanted to know, how would you relate for a layman in terms of the relationship between a social movement like Shetkari Sangatana and the phrase cultivating community?
When I began looking at the movement, as I mentioned, I was trying to understand how it is that, at least to appearances, such a broad swath of society can come together and say the same things, identify each other with such clarity, struggle for the same outcomes. And then I was, the second question that extends from that is, how does this happen? How, you know, who makes that possible? Is it because leaders are very charismatic and they're able to sort of craft a hegemonic ideology that everybody buys into and some of them are being hoodwinked? Or is there something else going on? And as I dug more deeply into the movement and realized how many other kinds of interests were being expressed in the movement and how many other kinds of things really were on the movement's agenda at the village level, if not at the level of the top leadership, I realized that the movement was really being cultivated or crafted by everybody in it. It, rather than it being sort of a single interpretive community where they all sort of hear this ideology in the same ways and abide by it in the same ways and commit their hearts and their lives to the movement in the same ways, it was really much more of sort of a dialogical community. There was a dialogue going on across all of these different interest groups and different personal and familial and village level agendas that were in the act of that dialogue, actively cultivating what the community becomes. And it's a little, obviously there's a little play on words there because they're all cultivators as well. But that was the part that I found fascinating. And I think one of the big themes in the book is that we shouldn't look at the movement so much as a singular, bounded, coherent, solidified thing with a singular identity and a singular set of goals, but rather as this relatively amorphous, relatively ambiguous, relatively porous thing that is kind of like a constellation of interests. It's kind of a sort of a coalescing of different patterns of interest into a relatively stable sort of engagement that looks thing-like, and that is what the movement is. It's not this single coherent community.
That's beautifully articulated, Michael. I just want to end by probably looking at the suggestion that you give towards the end of the book is about rethinking our understanding of leaders and the role of leadership in social movements. If I may ask two related questions there, would you therefore treat the Shetkari Sanghatana, if I may put it in a very pedestrian way, as a successful social movement? And would you also then think that Sharad Joshi was in that sense a successful leader?
This is a great question, and it's a question that I've left unanswered in the book. Because successful social movement implies that the movement has one idea of success. Because the movement is less thing-like and less a single coherent objective as it appears, I think we have to take the idea of success on a sort of a case-by-case basis. We have to speak with particular interest groups within the movement and inquire whether it's been successful for them in their own estimation. Now, in some ways, you could argue that the movement as a whole was successful in the sense that it evolved quite a bit over time. Sharad Joshi himself, despite his protestations that he would never do this, joined the national government as at a cabinet level position, where he was able to pursue some of the Shetkari Sanghatana agenda through the structures of power rather than just in an oppositional position. A lot of people objected to this, and a lot of people felt that he had sold out many of the people participating in the movement. Others applauded it as sort of the next level of victory for the movement. So I think if you look at the movement as a whole, there's that question of whether that was a success or a drawback or a failure. But on a village-by-village level and a family-by-family level or even a regional level, I think success and failure is sometimes yes and sometimes no, and sometimes not yet determined because there are still people involved in that struggle. Certainly some villages were able to greatly advance their interests through participation in the movement, and others were probably frustrated and were not able to achieve what they wanted to achieve.
Thank you very much, Michael. On that note of successfulness, I must say that as far as the book is concerned, it indeed seems to be a great success, at least definitely in making us rethink our current notions of social movements, very theoretically nuanced and very well written. So thank you for coming on my show today, explain to us the inspiration and the intricacies of the argument in this. And I hope we would get to read more from you. And maybe if you want to end by telling us what are you writing at the moment, or are you planning a sequel to this or anything at the moment that is part of your research?
I'm working on a couple of different projects, and thank you for asking. One is I'm doing a number of relatively short writing pieces, relatively short articles, trying to make some of the insights that I've taken from the Shetkari Sanghatana available to a broader, less academic audience, in order to shed light on some of the other phenomena that we see happening in the world today. Everything from the U.S. elections to some of the other social movements that are happening around the world, and trying to help us ask better questions about what's really happening within those phenomena. I also, as you may know, Sanjay, some of my work is in human-centered design, which is quite a different field. So I'm co-writing another book right now on human-centered design and some of the ways that we can approach the notion of the people that designers design for and what those communities are and the interrelations between the different folks in a social setting. Semi-related, very different audience.
Wish you all the best for your current and future endeavors, and looking forward to reading whatever comes out in the form of a book or otherwise. All the very best. And thank you once again, Michael. So you were listening to Michael Youngblood, speaking to us about his wonderful, exciting book, Cultivating Community, Interest, Identity and Ambiguity in an Indian Social Mobilization. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Sanjay.